So welcome everybody to the new time, the 8 p.m. Time. Hope this works out well. Maariv has been changed from 9:45 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. So we'll try to cut down the length of the shiur from an hour to 45 minutes. We'll see how that goes. And I want to dedicate tonight's shiur, L'zeich Benishmas, Dr. Richard Chaseman, who is a regular at this chabura, and unfortunately was niftar over Pesach. We're going to miss him. I know I'm going to miss him very much. He's a super, super genius, nuclear physicist. And he always had very good questions and very astute observations. Yehi zichro baruch. So a popular request has been for me to speak about inheritance and halacha and how the Bati Din deal with inheritance claims and cases nowadays. And we do get these types of cases where there will be family members who get into, unfortunately, rip-roaring battles regarding an inheritance of a parent, for example, with respect to who should get the inheritance, who should get what portion of the inheritance. And I can recall various such cases that have come into the best, and some of them have involved the regular cases of the distribution of money and normal assets like real estate, like books, like bank accounts, and things of that variety. And I had one case that came to us that had to do with dynastic inheritance, where there was a Hasidic dynasty and they were closing down the shtiebel, and there was a question of how to distribute the various artifacts among family members, the Bekesher, the Strimo, the Gartel, a particular letter that was received from this Alter Rebbe, from that Alter Rebbe. And I remember that we had to take all of the objects that were in dispute and place them in safe deposit boxes in a nearby bank, so the bank didn't understand. We're putting like these bathrobes and belts and things in the safety deposit boxes, and we said, you have to guard this. This is of such immense value. It meant a lot. Sentimental value. I was called by a Wall Street Journal reporter when there was the dispute regarding who would be the heir to the Satmar dynasty when the Satmar Rebbe died, and there was a fight between two different factions over which son was going to be the next Satmar Rebbe, and one of them ended up in Monroe and one of them ended up in Williamsburg, different places. So they had different groups. So the question was, how do you determine the real heir? And the question was, is this something that a regular secular court would be equipped to deal with? So they asked me to write an article in the Wall Street, the only time I ever wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal. I was very surprised, because normally I write articles, so I'm just happy if anybody reads the article. Here I actually received a check in the mail. I got a check from Dow Jones. It was a press release. It was really exciting. I did it. And then 6 months later, I got another check from Dow Jones. I figured, wow, I'm getting royalties. So I called them up, and I said, I'm sort of surprised. I didn't really expect that this would be a recurring check. So then it turned out, because I published the article under my English name, which is Jonathan Rees, turned out there was another Jonathan Rees, who was a hedge fund manager, who wrote another article 6 months later for the Wall Street Journal. So they saw my name, and they had my address information, so they shipped me the other check as well. But it turned out the other check was really destined for him. So I told them, it's okay, I'm not going to cash the check. I'll be happy to return it. So I just have to keep a good name for the world of business.
Was it from one money or same amount of
money? I think it was the same amount of money. I think it was basically the same. No, I think it was more. I think it was the same amount of money, if I recall correctly. When I did write the article for the Wall Street Journal, I wrote about how these types of matters, so any type of monetary dispute is supposed to be adjudicated in Beis Din as opposed to civil court. And I pointed out that this is true of a regular battle regarding inheritance, but it resonates all the more so when you're dealing with issues that the secular world would have no understanding of at all when you're dealing with dynastic inheritance. We had that in the Daf Yomi recently in the Gemara in Horios that spoke about how a melech of Yarshins, a melech inherits a position from his father who was a melech. If you have somebody who's the king, then if the son is roi, if he is considered to be suitable for the task because he has Yirah Shemayim, that's how we define, the Gemara in Ksuba says that we define a person's suitability for being a king, whether he's the Melech Yisrael or whether he's a Nasi of the community by whether or not he's a Yari Shemayim. So assuming that he's a Roy, that he's a Yari Shemayim, so he inherits the mantle of kingdom from the father. But it says that if there is a fight, if for whatever reason there is some dissent as to which son is really the most eligible, is the most suitable to receive the mantle of kingdom from the father, so then normally you don't have to have an anointment ceremony because it's just automatic. But if there is a squabble, so then you need to have an anointment with the Shemen HaMishcha, with the oil of anointment that was manufactured in the Mishkan that was used in the Beis HaMikdash. So I said that a lot really depends on whether or not there is a machlokis. If there is a large public squabble, so then it's not an automatic thing, and then you have to have some type of an official statement and an official ceremony which appoints who the successor is going to be in this type of dispute. So I wrote all this up in my Wall Street Journal article. There was a special section that was for a Tay section where they devoted every Wednesday to matters of religion. I don't know if anybody subscribes to the Wall Street Journal, if they still have this.
Right? Yeah, but I think they have it on Friday or
they have it. Okay, I think there was Wednesday at that point. Or maybe it was Friday. It's hard to remember. I did subscribe for a short period of time to the Wall Street Journal. They shouldn't think that they got nothing out of it from it, other than the article. Right, yeah. They have to pay me money. Right? So the basic theme, however, that I really wanted to emphasize, I didn't want to talk about the Satmar dynasty battle at all because I didn't know anything about it and I didn't want to impugn anybody, so I made that very, very clear. So I just kind of gave short shrift to that whole story, and then I just wrote about the role of Beis Din in general. So one of the questions that arises when there are inheritance disputes is, what is the standard of law that's followed by the Beis Din? We spoke at some point earlier about the application of the principle of Dina D'Malchus Adina, the law of the land. When is it that when Beis Din adjudicates a case that they have to apply what is the law of the land? The law of the land might be very different than what the halakhic disposition would be. There are two different types of situations that could arise when you have an inheritance matter. One is when the person who died passes away intestate. Intestate means that he didn't leave a will of any sort. So then there are automatic rules as to how the Yerusha, how the inheritance passes on to the heirs. First of all, there are rules as to how you define the heirs, and then how you define the portions that pass down to the heirs. So under American law, standard civil law, let's say a person has three sons and three daughters, so the three sons and the three daughters would each receive equal portions. And then there's the question, let's say that one of the sons or one of the daughters passed away and then they have their own children. So there are two different ways in which you can determine how those grandchildren would receive the share that otherwise would have gone to the parent. One is called per capita and the other is called per stirpes. What is per capita? Per capita means, so let's say a person has six children. The six children have 20 grandchildren, but one of them had 10 children, one of them had two children, one of them had four children. It doesn't really matter that you just divide each of those 20 children. If there are no children around anymore, only grandchildren, so the grandchildren, each one of the 20 would get the same amount. That's per capita. Per stirpes would be that each one of the children was entitled to 1/6. So if they were one of the children passed away but left 10 children, so each of those 10 children have to divide between themselves that 1/6. And if one of them had one child, that child receives the entire 1/6. That would be a per stirpes approach. So halacha follows a per stirpes approach in that sense, but what is different in the halacha is that the halacha says that if I have six children, three of which are sons and three of which are daughters, only the sons inherit and the daughters don't inherit at all. If it turns out, for example, that one of the sons died and he left a daughter, so then the daughter gets everything that son otherwise would have inherited. So that's the way in which a daughter can inherit, not by being a daughter, by being a granddaughter, she's able to inherit. Or if there are no sons, that's the whole story of Benos Slavkot. If there are no Zohar sons, so then the daughters inherit. And let's say that there are three sons and one of the sons was a firstborn child. Like Yehuda Dov over here, he's my firstborn child. So I have five sons, Baruch Hashem, I know, five. So Yehuda Dov is entitled to a double portion. He gets Pishnayim. I hope he never gets to collect, but this is that there's Pishnayim, we should all just keep on living, Abiyas Gold Tzedek. But the Bechor, the firstborn, is entitled to a double portion. What does that mean? It means that if I have three sons, so then the inheritance gets split up into four portions, and you add one more portion. The Bechor, the firstborn, gets two-fourths of those four portions, and the other two sons get one-fourth, one-quarter of those two portions. So it would be true if any, let's say there were five sons. It gets split up into six portions. The eldest son, the Bechor, would receive two-sixths, which would be one-third, and each one of the other four sons would receive one-sixth. So that's the way in which you would split up the estate. The daughters could be entitled to be supported until they get married, from assets to be fed, that they should be sustained, but they don't get an actual Yerusha. They don't get an actual portion of inheritance. The Torah law is different from the secular law in terms of how the Yerusha would be distributed if somebody dies intestate for sure. So do we follow the secular law? Do we say that this is a case where Dina de Machusa Dina governs, or is it a case where the halachic disposition would govern? So that's one scenario. A second scenario is where there actually is a will. Somebody left a will. So do we say that when there's a will, there's a way? Do we say that if a person left a will, so then there's a way to have the person distribute the assets any which way that they want? So that raises the question. Does a person have shlita? Does a person have control to say, well, this is a monetary matter? I mean, the Torah has all kinds of monetary rules. It has monetary rules if I'm a watchman over somebody else's property, and if I'm not getting paid for being a watchman, so I'm a shomer chinam. So if what I am watching, the deposit that is with me should end up being stolen or lost. So since I'm an unpaid watchman, so then I'm not responsible. The Mishnah and Gemara and the Baba Metzia, I think Tzadi Beis, Tzadi Dal, so the Mishnah, so they give it the Sugi over there, says that I can make a stipulation with you. You're giving me the deposit, maybe it's a gold watch, whatever it is, so we can stipulate that even though I'm not being paid for it, and normally an unpaid watchman is not chayev for Geneva Va'aveda, but we're stipulating I am going to be chayev for Geneva Va'aveda. Or maybe I am a paid watchman, and a paid watchman normally is chayev for Geneva Va'aveda, and we stipulate I'm not going to be chayev for Geneva Va'aveda. We can make any kind of condition that we want if it's a davashim amamun. Why is that? Because we have a machlokus between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir as to whether komasna if I make a condition with respect to a Torah law that is in the monetary sphere, is the condition considered to be binding? Is it not considered to be binding? According to Rabbi Meir, you can't do that. What right do you have to make a Tanaya condition against that rule which is explicitly stipulated in the Torah? Therefore, your condition is considered to be null and void. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. Rabbi Yehuda has a different opinion. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, it's a monetary matter. Monetary matters. It's not like it's making a condition with respect to a ritual prohibition, that you're making a condition between the two of you that you're going to violate Shabbos, which is the two of you that you're going to eat pork. No, you're making a condition that between the two of you, you're just going to adjust your monetary relationship a little bit different. Your person, you could be mochel. Monetary obligations, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do something like that. So therefore, says Rabbi Yehuda, such a condition would be valid. So there's a question. Maybe a person makes conditions. They devise a will. They devise a will, and they say, even though I had six children, and really according to Torah law, the three sons should have gotten everything, and the Bechor should have gotten the double portion, and the daughters shouldn't have gotten anything, I'm going to divide everything equal between all six of my children, and everybody's going to get one-sixth. Everybody's going to get exactly the same amount. So why can't I do that? Why don't I say that this is a Tanayik B'davah Shiva moment? So that's a maybe. It's a better. Maybe if there is an explicit contract, the person didn't die intestate. They made an explicit will in which they devised their assets. Maybe that should be enforceable. So it's interesting. But Moshe Feinstein addresses both of these issues, and he comes out with different conclusions regarding the two different questions. And we paskin like him. Everybody agrees with him regarding his first conclusion, and pretty much everybody disagrees with him regarding his second conclusion. So first he deals with the case where a person who dies intestate. So that's the first source over here. You see over here I have a list of 10 different questions from the Dayan's desk. Can inheritance matters be adjudicated by Beis Din? So he said, yes, that was my Wall Street Journal article. We've addressed that. Is a will enforceable as a matter of Jewish law? We'll have to see. What happens if there is no will? So those are the two questions that we just discussed. Do daughters inherit? So he said, it's a normal matter. daughters don't inherit. What's the double portion of the firstborn? Is it applicable nowadays? Double portion of the firstborn? We mentioned already. You add an extra portion and you say the one who's the poor gets a double portion of that. So is it applicable nowadays? Of course, all the Torah is applicable nowadays. Is there an effective way to change the Torah scheme of inheritance? So that's the question. Is a will considered to be enforceable or not? Is a will not considered to be enforceable? So let's try to address these different questions that I've raised regarding the Dina de Malchusa Dina aspects of a person who dies intestate or a person who has a will. Yes, Ira, you had a question.
I was going to say that when I've drafted wills from people, I've often been told that there's a device that people use. I guess the best way to one of them is 2 minutes before I die, I hereby give away all my assets.
We're going to have to talk about
that.
So I
die intestate, or I am making an obligation on my son, you have a duty to support all of your siblings and your mother, and if you don't do that, that's okay, just be moichel it, you're moichel it, now we'll let the wills control.
Something like that,
yeah.
Something like that, we're going to get to that. So you're mentioning, for example, when I devise my will, which I did with you, I'll give you free publicity over here, so it says that when you turn, there's a sefer that says Chaim Ibrachim Mishmeres Shalom. That sefer has all kinds of different laws, and he talks about some of the laws of how a person is supposed to prepare themselves. La'acha me'eres umshana. He says that the appropriate age in which a person is supposed to devise a will, if they haven't done so previously, but an appropriate age, he says, is when you turn 50 years old. So it wasn't that long ago that I turned 50 years old. So it says in the Torah, "Bishnasa Yovel Azos Tashuvu Yishal Achuzaso." Then this year, that on the Yovel year, a person's Yovel year, their Jubilee year, when they turn 50, Tashuvu Yishal Achuzaso. So they should be prepared for what's going to happen in terms of matters of inheritance. That they should prepare a will at that point in time. So when I went to prepare my will, so I went to the local Cracker Jack lawyer over here, and I said that we have to have some sort of a supplementary document that's going to make it work. So we're going to talk about that supplementary document. But the first question is, maybe you don't need a supplementary document. Maybe you could just have a regular will.
Somebody told me Rav Aharon Soloveitchik held in that respect.
We'll have to see.
Quoting this off the top of my head. I don't
We're going to quote Ramosha Feinstein. So Ramosha Feinstein has a tshuva on this subject. So first of all, Ramosha says, do you apply the general rules of Dina de Malchusa that if a matter, every single matter that needs to be adjudicated monetarily has to be brought in front of the Beis Din? But do you say that the Beis Din follows the principles of Dina de Malchusa as pertaining to a dispute between two Jews? So take a look. At the beginning over here, we've seen this before, so we'll run through it quickly, just the part we didn't focus on, the part that pertains to this discussion. That's why I have it bolded, for your convenience. There's a big machlokis as to when it applies. The Rama says, it applies all over the place. So that can't be. Mashkasa Rama, to Lomina Dina Machusa Dina, Lubadava Sheshba and Alamelk, Shulukas Bene Medina, that the Rama says it really only applies to matters of broad sweeping regulation. So it can't be that when the Rama said earlier on that we say it Pechodava with respect to everything, so says the Smart, and that can't be regarding everything. It must be. It's modified by what he says later on. It's only when it's something of broad sweeping application that if you changed how you would do things in one case, that would mess up the entire government's regulatory system. So he says, no matter how sweeping or broad a definition of Dina de Malchusa Dina you have, that's if it has to do with like a bankruptcy matter, where it would be very counterproductive to the entire system that has been set up by the government if you would treat different creditors different in a way that is not consistent with how you treat other creditors. That's going to bring to all kinds of fights and disputes and inequities. Maybe, you know, the executive branch is going to be concerned about this. That you shouldn't have other courts deciding these cases in a different fashion. It's going to thwart and going to mess up the entire system. And then people will say that the government's laws don't work. And this is the ballpark, where the government's not going to care if a person has a private contract in which they decide that in an individual case they're going to, as between one particular family or one particular group of people, that they're going to do things their own way. Like with respect to whether the daughter inherits together with the son or not, this is not something which it has an effect or an impact on the country writ large. That everybody, lots of people decide that they're going to enter into wills and they devise their estates in a way which is not necessarily the scheme that would have been devised, let's say, if a person would have been left into, would have died intestate. So says Rav Moshe, therefore, the general rules of application of who inherits what and what amount are clearly not something that the government cares that deeply about, because then they would never allow anybody to change what the scheme is by making a will, right? So therefore, says Rav Moshe, the laws of Dina D'Malchus HaDina are not applicable to this particular type of situation. Now, you can raise the question, is there any sort of public policy threshold? In other words, let's say a person chooses to disinherit. You can speak to this, Ira. Let's say a person is married and they choose to disinherit their wife entirely. Does the person have a right to do that according to the Din of the Malchusa?
Ostensibly, yes, but that will is going to get challenged instantly and may lose a court challenge. You better have really, really, really specific grounds in which to do it. And it's not going to apply to any assets that A, were in joint tenancy, or B, if there's a community property consideration.
Community property is a different story. Yeah. Then you're taking away from somebody a right, a stake in a property that they have title.
To say that there's no public policy consideration is not 100% correct. One of the big debate period in what the new law, which is now known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, was the whole debate on estate tax and the estate tax threshold. So the government has a very large precipice in knowing as in what's inherited, because
knowing what's inherited is a different story than deciding who's going to inherit it.
But no, that is because you went to law school. There's a whole class in wills and trusts, generation skipping trusts, and various devices and Q-tips. The government has a big interest in knowing who owns the asset, who's going
to
get it, who should be.
So the basic story is that we have to adjust this. Okay,
yeah.
So let's try to reframe the answer then. Then really what Rav Moshe is saying is that there certainly is no Din and the Malchus controlling that would limit a person from, or limit a Bezdin from deciding that an estate should be divided in accordance with Torah law. But that doesn't mean that one can ignore the other aspects of a secular estate law that are binding upon everybody, such as, for example, the payments of estate tax and the determination of what is the threshold for which there's an exemption on the estate tax, after which the estate tax is going to have to be paid. Obviously, that would enter into the realm. So what we're talking about right now is in terms of just the determination of who inherits. So let's take a look. We have this psukim. This is a Torah Shebichtav, really, to a large degree. We have the psukim in B'nidbar Perek of Zayin that talk about exactly how an estate is supposed to be divided. Only if there's no son, if there are no sons, does the Yerusha go to the daughters. Otherwise, Yerusha goes to sons, it doesn't go to daughters. Let's say there are no sons and no daughters. So then, according to Torah law, the Yerusha would go, it goes to the brothers. Now, that's assuming the Torah Shebaal Peh kicks in. That's assuming that there's no father to receive it. If they were the person who died left a father, then the father would receive it. The father, wife doesn't inherit according to Torah law. A husband inherits the wife. The wife does not inherit the husband according to Torah law. What the wife is entitled to according to Torah law is the kesuba. She gets the payment of the kesuba. The kesuba, if she chooses not to receive the kesuba right away, then she is entitled to be sustained from the assets of the estate until such time as she decides that she's going to collect the kesuba. She gets remarried. So she does have a large entitlement, but that large entitlement is connected not to rights of inheritance, but rather to rights of collection under the kesuba. So that's an important distinction to be aware of. Yes?
What if the wife has a prenuptial agreement?
So that's an interesting question. So this goes to the question of tonight. Can you make a condition with respect to an inheritance that is different from what the Torah scheme of inheritance could be. In other words, that the Torah scheme of inheritance says that a wife doesn't inherit the husband, but the prenuptial agreement says wife shall inherit the husband. So that's question number two that we're going to have to confront, which is our conditions with respect to how you bequeath your assets considered to be binding based on the principle of kol tanai shebamamon kayem, based on the principle that you can make conditions with respect to monetary matters. We're going to get to that in a moment. It's a very good question, right? Okay, so that's the Torah scheme of inheritance. Basically, whenever there are, if there are brothers, let's say that there are no sons and no daughters, there are no children, the person's father already passed away, he only has brothers, the brothers receive the estate. Let's say that there were no brothers, the only sisters. The sisters receive the estate, and if any of those people had already passed away, then it goes to their children again. If their children consist of boys, then the boys get it. If they're boys and girls, the boys get it. If there are no boys, only girls, then the girls get it, right? Okay, so you can have a person who has a son and a daughter, right? And they both passed away, and their estate, and the son left one daughter, and the daughter left two sons, and in that particular case, the son who left one daughter, that daughter is going to receive 50% of the estate, and that granddaughter, and the two sons who came from the one daughter, are going to get, I'm sorry, in this case, left a son and a daughter, the daughter is going to get 100% of the estate, and the two grandsons are going to get 0% of the estate. That's right. So, you know, so the way it plays out can be very, very interesting. Now, what about the Pishnayim of the Bechor? That's the Parsha in Devarim. That's the section that talks about Kisyen Lishtein Hashem. Person has two wives. One is Ahuva, one is Snua. What does it mean loved? What does it mean hated? Doesn't matter. The point of the Parsha is, let's say the one who is hated, or the one whose marriage is not quite as glatt, but nonetheless it's a binding marriage, has a son, and that son happens to be this man's firstborn son. Even though he may love his second son, who was born from the other wife more, it doesn't matter. This son receives a double portion. The Rambam writes that this is a mitzvah from the Torah, one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, that you have to see to it that a son receives a second portion. That this is you have an obligation really to ensure that this is not something that will be foregone, that it is a very important value that a firstborn son receives his double portion. So what happens if a person wants to fiddle with the laws of inheritance? So this is a very interesting sugya. Do we say, in fact, that inheritance is a davar shebamamon, that it is a monetary matter where the person is allowed to make a condition? If you just looked at the Mishnah and the Gemara, it would seem that maybe a person really could do that. But as we know, that when you learn a sugya in depth, things are seldom what they seem. So let's take a look at the Mishnah. Mishnah says, Omer, somebody says, that my firstborn son should not receive a double portion. My son should not receive a portion together with his brothers. Lo amar klum. Doesn't count. Why? Because he has made a condition against that which is contained in the Torah. So says the Gemara, So it must be that our Mishnah is going against Rabbi Yehuda. We just got through saying we have a machlokis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda in this regard, but according to Rabbi Yehuda, you are allowed to make a tanaya, a condition with respect to a monetary matter. So why couldn't you make a condition? Where would you be making a condition? It's what Iowa we would call a will, right? A person's last will and testament, that's where he would be making the condition. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, says the Gemara, that really should work. And in fact, the Gemara brings as the analog the case where a person is making a condition when they marry a woman, and they say, I'm marrying you, I'm betrothing you, on condition that I am not obligated to provide you with sustenance or with clothing. There's no share and no ksusa obligation. Ona, he goes even further and says, I'm not obligated in conjugal relations. Okay, that we're not going to allow him to do, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, because that's not a davar shebamamon. But Titania, Omen Lisha, Ram, Kadeshus, Liam, and Ashay, Nakalai, Sheikh, Susu, Ona, Harezum, and Kadeshus, Tano, Batu, Divri, Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says the Kedushin is valid, but Titania, the condition is null and void. Rabbi Yehuda, Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Bidavar shebamamon, Tano, Kayim, with respect to the share and the Kasus, leave aside the Ona, with respect to providing her with sustenance and providing her with clothing, if she agrees that she's not going to accept it, then that's part of the condition upon which the marriage with the betrothal was consummated. So no kayim. So then the condition will be valid. Answers the Gemara, no. Our Mishnah can even be going according to Rabbi Yehuda. Feel the same of Rabbi Yehuda. Now, why can it even be going according to Rabbi Yehuda? Why? The answer is going to be very important. So what's the answer? The answer is, Hagan Yadra Kamachla. In that case, he's marrying, he's giving a ring to the woman. He's saying to the woman, you want to be my wife? So then you have to waive your rights to support and to my buying you clothing. And she says, okay, look, I got to marry somebody, so you're a creep, but you know, I got to have children, so I'll marry you anyway. And she agrees to the terms. She's mokel. She waives her rights. Haka lo kamokel. But here, the yoresh was in mokel. We assume the yoresh was not mokel. We assume that the person whom the testator wished to disinherit did not agree to be disinherited. So I ask you a question. The implication of the Gemara, let's say the person did agree to be disinherited. Let's say the person says, you want to disinherit me? Fine. Put in your will. Whatever you want to do, Dad. You put in your will, you're going to disinherit me. That's okay. I love you. And you decide to do whatever you want to do. So would that be valid? Would it not be valid? It sounds a little bit from the Gemara that it would be valid. It comes along the Rashba. The Rashba says, no. That would be a misinterpretation and a misunderstanding of the Gemara. Says that the Rashba, Mistava da'ayit kama mamach alav davka. The fact that the Gemara gives this reason and says, well, the Yoresh was not mochel, that is not the controlling reasoning over here. It's just throwing that in for good measure. Throwing it for good measure, because who's going to want to waive the inheritance that they would otherwise be entitled to? Divide that, Fila Mokhla Bein Mefesh says, even if the Bein, the son would say, absolutely, I waive my inheritance, he does not have the ability to waive his inheritance. The also lo klum, the mechila, what's the reason? So what's the reason for this? The Rashba says, it doesn't count, even if you would have all of the necessary conditions in place, that there would be a tanai shem mamon. The person who's entitled to the benefit says that they waive the benefit. So you would figure that they, under such conditions, a person would be allowed to make a will, would be allowed to disinherit somebody or to change the conditions of inheritance that would otherwise be imposed by the Torah. So the Rashba says it doesn't work. You know why it doesn't work? Because the mechila mamash enu shelo adayin. Because it does not belong to him yet. Okay? It doesn't belong to him yet. In other words, he has no rights with respect to it. You can't be mokel something that is not within your hands. If it would be in his hands, so then he can give it away to somebody else. He receives the inheritance, he can go to his sister and say, here, take 50% of my inheritance, or take 25% of my inheritance. It's not in his hands. But really, the main svara of the Rashba is the words that come next. V'asi lavalo memela. He can't stop it. It is an unstoppable train. He can't stop the Yerusha from coming, because you know how Yerusha happens? It happens automatically. It happens what we call memela. A person dies, the Yerusha just goes. Why does the Yerusha just go automatically to the heirs? Because the Torah says so. Since it's something that happens automatically, I have no ability to govern the terms and conditions with respect to that which happens automatically. Let's just read this for a second. Mimer ki Yerusha sa'av enu yakol istarik memenav lo lamakwa. So therefore the person does not have the right to separate himself from the inheritance that he is going to receive, and he can't sell it yet because it has not yet come into his hands. But he quotes at the end the Rashbam. Look at the third to the last line. Remember, Divrei Rashbam Zal, it's Rash, but he means Rashbam, commentator on the Gemara Bava Basra. You remember that Rashi dies towards the beginning of Maseches Bava Basra, so towards the end of Bava Basra, you have the laws of inheritance in Yesh Noklin, Perek Yesh Noklin, that's already the Rashbam. Nira, Shehu Savor, it appears that the Rashbam is of the opinion, Shemakla Ben Meretzan Mechilas Mechila, that if the son on his own accord decides that he's going to waive the Yerusha, then that would be a valid waiver. Shekach Kosta, because what's the wording of the Rashbam? The Rashbam wrote, Val Hakam Mimachil, over here, who is waiving the inheritance? Ma Na Yeshu Ben Shimko. Why would the son have a benefit from waiving his inheritance? Rabbi Bishashasaka Bain, even if the Bain was quiet, that doesn't mean that he agreed to the stipulation of his father. Ainsu Mechida Dein Rotzel Akis is of it, he just does not want to rattle the old man, and that's why he didn't say anything. But it's mashma, it appears from the Rashbam, that if he says explicitly, yes, Abba, I agree, yes, Tati, I agree, so then that would be a valid waiver according to the Rashbam. The Einam Mechuba Be'enai. But the Rashbam says that I do not agree. I feel that because Yerusha is something that just happens mimela, it just happens without anyone's control. The individual dies, and at that point, the assets of the estate automatically pass to the heirs. There's no way to stop the heirs from receiving that portion, even if the will would stipulate otherwise. In fact, the Hagos Eretz Tzvi, since they publish on the Gemara that you'll find in the back of the Gemara, I assume that at this point in time you'll find it in a section that says Chidushim, you know, collected Chidushim on each page of the Gemara. Everything is now collected together. It's all amalgamated together. So that goes, I think I saw it just on the pages of an old Gemara. He says, V'chakam ekad sheyichyeh. He says there was a chakam. He doesn't say who is this chakam. There was some chakam, okay, an unnamed, anonymous chakam. Herali showed me, sheyigia b'shash shelo, he had a different girsa in his Gemara. In his Gemara it says, the Ketzalach Lomar Baba Yerusha, afino mako beperish lo abe mechila. Even though our text of the Gemara says, hasam yada v'kamakla haka lo kamakla, his text of the Gemara, which has not yet been inserted in any official edition of the Gemara that I have come across, but his edition of the Gemara said when it comes to inheritance matters, it says explicitly, afino mako beperish, even if the heir waived his right to the inheritance explicitly, lo abe mechila, that waiver would not count at all. V'chei nachon, and in fact, this is correct. This becomes a very strong sentiment in Rishonim. That is one approach as to why, if you would change the terms in a will, it would not be effective. Because otherwise, you'll say, oh, but you can give away things in your lifetime. I can give you a gift in my lifetime, right? But when does a will become effective? It becomes effective after death. After death, the only way that assets are transferred is through the mechanism of Yerusha, inheritance. An inheritance is not something that an individual has the ability to make a condition about. Yes, so we had two questions. Go ahead.
The famous case where a grandfather, upon his death, made a statement that if one of my grandchildren marries a boy, he doesn't get a portion of the estate. Now, that went to court, and I think they took that clause as not effective.
That's if you go to court. But we started asking, first of all, as a matter of halakha, she wouldn't, was she a granddaughter from a son or from a daughter? So that we have to refer, as a matter of halakha, it could be she wouldn't have had a right to inherit anyway. And if her parent was still alive, she certainly wouldn't have the right to inherit, because under halakha, the grandchildren only inherit if the parent would have had the ability to inherit. So there are a lot of questions over here, but that really goes to our threshold question. The threshold question was, do you adjudicate these matters in secular court according to secular law? Do you adjudicate these matters in Beis Din according to halakha? So he said that there is no controlling secular law does not control. Dina de Malchus, Dina does not control when it comes to inheritance law. You have to go to the Beis Din and have the Beis Din decide the case according to halakha. If you went to secular court, the secular court gave you something that you weren't entitled to according to halakha, and all of the other Yorshim are screaming and yelling, you have no right to take us to secular court, this matter should be adjudicated in Beis Din, you're a thief. You're a ganav under those circumstances. Could be the secular court gave it to you, but you're not entitled to it according to halakha. Yes?
So in response to what he said, I think the case was a little bit different. I think it's this woman's right. Grandfather makes a will. He says that my grandkids marry non-Jews. They're disinherited. The grandkid married a non-Jew. Then the grandkid had died, and the family sought to have the transfer of the grandson's estate go to the non-Jew granddaughter, and the court ruled in favor of the granddaughter because that inheritance had already vested.
Okay.
So I think it was, and that is a significant difference, because you do have a right to dictate under secular law, you know, conditions.
Under secular law, for sure, right?
In this case, though, I mean, you said the Yerusha, you know, the Rashba says the Yerusha comes like a train. The fact of the matter is that we do know
an unstoppable train,
but except that we do know there are stops. In other words, I can be moichel. If I do something, if I have a right to something, I can, you know.
But that's the type of thing that doesn't come to you automatically. If something is going to come to you automatically, the thing about a Yerusha is that it just comes automatically. As soon as the person dies, all of their assets, according to Torah law, they automatically transfer over to the heir.
But then there's another piece to this that we're not talking about.
I might have a Yerusha where this isn't true. Meaning, let's say that something was not automatically coming to me anyway. What's the case where something wasn't automatically coming to me anyway? What's the one Yerusha that we spoke about where when I'm born, for example, this is not something which is automatically going to be coming to me anyway? The Yerusha of a Kahuna, no. Kahuna, I'm born to my father. I'm a Kohen. That's it. You know, it's done.
Kahuna Malchus.
The husband. Yeah, there's a Ziver, you know, B'Shamayim. We assume that there's a bas call that went out. But still, there's a certain amount of volition involved in who you're going to marry. A person might have, you know, a Besheret that is destined for him according to some supernatural decree, but if he decides not to marry that woman, he's not going to inherit her. He gets to decide whether or not he's going to marry her. Therefore, he can make a calculation according to the Gemara. The Gemara in Ksuvos says that a man has the right to make a tanai, to make a condition with respect to a nakla b'olo mimakum acher, with respect to an inheritance that's coming to him from somewhere else. That's a strange lashon, coming to him from somewhere else. So the way in which some Rishonim understand this, referring to the husband's inheritance of his wife, he can say prior to the point in time in which it would be vested, it's only vested at the time of Nisuin, not at the time of Erisin. You're speaking about vested. When he betroths the woman, he's not entitled to inherit her yet. He only gets to inherit her at the time of Nisuin, when there is a full-fledged marriage, that she comes into his home. She's an Eishes Ish B'Beis Habaal. When you have a chuppah, you have a Nisuin only at that point in time. Says the Gemara, from the time of the Erisin, he has the right, between the time of the Erisin and the time of Nisuin, to say, I am going to stipulate that I am not going to inherit from you. They can enter into a prenuptial agreement that will say that the husband, that the to-be and the wife-to-be agree that in this particular case, the husband is not going to inherit from his wife. Why is that? So Machlokas Rishonim as to why he has the right to do that. According to some Rishonim, it's because that the inheritance of a husband from his wife is only midrabanan. It's only rabbinic. So rabbinic, a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more wiggle room. Others say nothing doing. A husband's right to inherit his wife is actually midaraisa. It's actually minatora. Why then does he have the right to waive? We just got through saying you don't have the right to waive an inheritance. The answer is, explains the Rashba, the same, you know, the Rashba says this as well. The Rashba says that because this is not automatic, he has a point in time in which he can say, before I enter into this marriage relationship, and I would have the right to that Yerusha, I'm going to relinquish the right. It's not going to be Memela because it hasn't yet already been vested. Otherwise, when we have a mechila, you're basically being mocha something that has already vested, and then you don't have the ability to give it away until it comes into your hands. But before it comes into your hands, either you don't have it yet physically, but it's vested, so you have rights to it, and at the moment in time in which it's going to be transferred over, it's going to be transferred over mimela. It's going to happen automatically. As opposed to the husband, when does his Yerusha become vested? Only when he marries, he does the Nisuin, he has the ability between the Eris and Nisuin to say, no, I agree that I am not going to inherit my wife. So that's going to be the one exception to the rule. So we see, by the way, it's not an absolute across-the-board categorical principle. Isn't that interesting? And we understand that according to the Rashba, we need certain technicalities to be in place in order for the condition to be null and void. And those technicalities include that this is something which is going to be asid lavo lo. It's already been vested that it's going to come to him. Then already it's an uncontrollable runaway train, and it's going to come to him eventually. Mimela, says the Rashba, that's not true with respect to the inheritance of a husband from his wife. Okay, now that's one approach. That's the Rashba's approach. There's another approach.
That he may die first. He may not get anything from the wife.
Yeah, but he says that
so
even
not
in the
a
event
sure
of
thing, I mean, he's no, local, so he's no. That's,
anybody could die. No,
Dabar Shlomo.
No, anybody could die first. I mean, yeah. The person could die first before a parent passes away. You know, Chas V'Shalom. But nonetheless, it's still something which is going to, when it does happen, it's going to happen mimela. Yes.
Who is the Eretz Tzvi?
The Eretz Tzvi, I don't remember his full name. Okay, we could look it up. He wrote Chidushim that are published in the back of the Gemara. Bli Nedra, I will get you his name. Let's read the Rambam before we kind of finish for today, because we only have about a minute and a half or so. So the Rambam gives you a totally different reason. He comes up with Gzeiras HaKasu. Very, very fascinating. Says that if you look, person doesn't have the ability to bequeath his inheritance to somebody who would not otherwise inherit him, like a daughter, right? And not to uproot a Yerusha from somebody who otherwise would inherit him, like a son. Even though it's mamonos. So you'll say, it's a Tanai Shimon Mamon. Why can't you just stipulate whatever you want in the will? The Bishan Namar, he says, because I have a pasuk. What's the pasuk? The Parashas Naklos, it says, the Haisel of Neisel, the Chukas Mishpah. It calls the disposition of a person's estate Chukas Mishpah. Chukas Mishpah means that it's a chukah. There's something which is very ritualistic about it. That just as you cannot make a tanai, you can't make a condition against the ritual laws of the Torah, you cannot make a condition which would change this ritual that the Torah requires. Because, says the Rambam, essentially what the Rambam is saying, this is not really mamonos. At the end of the day, even though it looks like mamonos, it looks like it's a monetary matter, it also has another aspect to it of chukas mishpat, of a ritual prohibition. It would be a ritual prohibition to change around the laws of the Torah, and that's why you can't make a condition, just like you can't make a condition in any type of ritual law of the Torah. Bein shetziva v'ubari, and this is whether the person is healthy, bein shehayashchimera, or whether the person is on his deathbed, or the person is very sick, and it's possible that this will be his final illness before he dies. Why does the Rama mention the person being on a sick bed? Because there is the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka that says that if a person is on their sick bed, then they do have the ability to make certain adjustments with respect to their Yerusha. They don't have the ability to bequeath their assets to a daughter who wouldn't otherwise inherit them. But what they can say is if there were three sons who would inherit them, at that point in time, they can say, oh, I'm going to, and let's say we're not dealing with a Pishnayim issue right now of a Bechor. Let's say none of them are a Bechor. The firstborn was a daughter. Each of them would get one third. He can say, I want this one to get one half, and I want this one to get one third, and I want this one to get one sixth, and a totally different disposition of the estate. A person has the ability to do that. The Gemara says, though, this special law of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka derived from V'hayah B'yom Anachilo Esbanav, that a person has a certain flexibility and discretion, that's only when they are on their deathbed, or when they are in they are bedridden and in dire straits. Only if they are a Shechim Meira does that count. If they're not a Shechim Meira, so then it doesn't count. So says the Rambam, you're going to bequeath to somebody who would not otherwise inherit you altogether, even if you're a Shechim Meira, even if the person's on their sick bed, it's not going to work. So therefore, we are stymied. According to the Rambam, it's Gzeiras HaKasuv, Chukas Mishpah. Where do you use the Gemara come up with that Gzeiras HaKasuv? Chazon Ish says, the Rambam made it up. There is no such drasha. But the Rambam, he's the Rambam. He's allowed to make up a drasha. He says it's a ritual law, you can't stipulate against it. The Rashba says, it's a milsa de memela. Either way, whether it's a milsa de memela, whether it's a ritual law, as a general rule, a person's not going to be able to make that stipulation. As we said, the one exception is the case of the husband. Right before he's going to marry his wife, he gets to make that stipulation. So we see it's not 100% absolute. We're going to see what other wiggle room there might be when we continue in Mitzvah Hashem next time.
I think there's one piece that might be mentioned. The son getting Pishnayim, the son comes, once the oldest son is the Bachor, the Pishnayim comes with a whole heck of a lot of responsibility.